She wasn't just a fashion designer. She was a predator with a needle and thread. Lyra Saint didn't create clothes. She sculpted masterpieces from pain, power, and the shattered pieces of her muses. But when Celeste walked into her studio, a model as manipulative as Lyra herself, the game changed. Love turned into war. Obsession became art. And in the end, only one woman would be left standing. This is a story of sexual manipulation, control, betrayal, and the dangerous beauty of falling in love with your own reflection. Welcome to the Skillful Art of Manipulation podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Dick by Design. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The First Stitch. They always think they discovered me. Every last one of them walks through the glass doors of my studio with that same half-cocked smile and eyes full of delusion, like they've stumbled upon something pure. Untouched, a secret gem buried in the wreckage of New York's fashion underbelly. They think I'm some miracle waiting to be branded, bought, and bagged. As if the fire in me didn't already burn through 100 men just like them. I don't get discovered. I create. And what I create, what I design, comes from something raw, twisted, sometimes beautiful, but always broken. Like me. The first time I saw Tristan, he was leaning against the arch of my showroom doorway, all legs and ego. The kind of man who wore his confidence like cologne, loud, intoxicating, and made to hide the rot underneath. 6'2", broad shoulders that made him look like a marble statue chiseled by the horny ghost of Michelangelo. His jaw was lined with just the right amount of stubble, and his eyes, dark brown, wide, vulnerable, carried that silent scream I'd seen in so many others before him. They don't know they're screaming, but I do. That's how I find them. I was sketching a long-bodied silhouette for a fall collection when he stepped in, but I didn't lift my head. Didn't need to. I could already feel the shift in the air, the weight of someone needing to be seen. "You Lyra Saint?" he asked, casual as hell, like my name wasn't etched into the goddamn fabric of fashion itself. "Depends," I murmured, not looking up. "You here to model or waste my time?" He chuckled, stepping deeper inside. "I heard you're the best. I want to be part of something bigger." I looked up then, slow, deliberate, like I was unwrapping a present I already knew I was going to return. My eyes met his and held there. I didn't smile. Didn't blink. I let the silence stretch like silk pulled taut between us. He was already mine. "Take your shirt off," I said, standing and setting my charcoal pencil down on the edge of the table. He hesitated, just for a second, but then he obeyed. "Good boy." His shirt dropped to the floor, revealing sculpted abs, soft caramel skin, and a tattoo across his chest that read "No regrets." "Cute," I said, stepping closer. "Let's see how long that holds up." He didn't flinch when I touched him, my fingers cold from hours of sketching. I traced his collarbone, slow and steady, like I was reading Braille on his bones. My nails grazed down his chest, stopping just above his waistband. He inhaled, shallow and shaky. "I can make you a star," I whispered, lips brushing against his ear. "But it'll cost you." He looked down at me with those desperate, beautiful eyes. "Whatever it takes." Poor thing. He really meant that. I called him Muse One in my notes. Never by name. Names made things personal. Names made people real. And the moment a man becomes real to me is the moment I lose my grip. I don't lose. Over the next 3 weeks, Tristan became my newest addiction. Not because he was interesting. Not because he was talented. But because he was willing. And willingness, that blind, eager surrender, is my drug of choice. We started with fittings. Casual touches. My fingers adjusting a seam near his inner thigh. My hand sliding across his hip to feel how the fabric fell. I told myself it was for the design. But it wasn't. I was testing him. Tasting the edge of his comfort. Seeing how far I could push before he broke. Turns out not far. He followed me around the studio like a pet, bringing coffee, hanging my fabrics, making soft moans when I brushed past him. He wanted me to notice him. He needed it, and so I gave him just enough to keep him on the hook. Then came the first night. It was raining. I remember because the thunder shook the windows like an omen. He stayed late to help with a late-night concept fitting. I told him to strip and stand in front of the floor-length mirror. He was nervous, excited, his cock already half-hard under the spotlight. I circled him, eyes devouring every inch of his reflection. Then I grabbed a spool of black silk and began wrapping it around his chest, tight, intentional, almost binding. "You're not just a model," I whispered, threading fabric across his skin. "You're a message. Your pain, desire, guilt, shame, and control." He swallowed hard. Control. I leaned into his back, lips at the base of his neck. Mine. That night, I fucked him against the mirror. Made him watch himself unravel under me. I whispered my visions between moans, told him how he would be the center of my next line, how his tears would become the texture in my coats, how his heartbreak would be stitched into every hem. And he let me. He cried, God, he cried, but not because he didn't want it. He cried because he did. After that, he stopped being Tristan. He became something else. My shadow. My echo. My muse. But muses burn out. And he burned fast. He stopped showing up on time. Got jealous when I worked with other models. Started asking questions. What are we? Why don't you treat me the same offset? Do you even care about me? No. No, I didn't. But I said nothing. I just watched him drown. He started drinking more. Showed up high once. Smelled like weed and cheap heartbreak. I should have fired him, but I didn't. I wanted to watch the collapse. And when it came, it was glorious. He showed up one night, drunk, shirtless, screaming about how I used him. He said I broke his spirit, turned his body into a costume for my fucked up fantasies. You don't see people, Lyra, he spat. You just take what you want and toss them like trash. I didn't yell. Didn't defend myself. I just stepped toward him, calm and composed. I see you, I whispered, brushing his jaw with the back of my hand. More clearly than anyone ever has. And I captured it. I held up my latest sketch. It was a jacket made entirely from jagged, uneven layers. Torn silk. Distressed leather. Raw seams. It's called Tristan, I said. Fall collection centerpiece. It drops next week. He stared at it, tears forming in his eyes, and I knew I had finally ripped the last piece of him apart. He left. Moved to LA. I heard rumors, drugs, failed auditions, a stint in rehab. He posted cryptic things online. Once tagged me in a photo of a burned Saint Disorder hoodie. Cute. But he was done. And I was already sketching the next one. That's the thing about muses. They're not meant to last. They're meant to ignite. And darling, I was on fire. Chapter 2. Fabric of Control. They say lightning never strikes twice. Those people have never met me. I don't wait for lightning. I summon it. I weave it into fabric, thread it through the minds of men, and wear it like a crown while they burn beneath me. Tristan was only the first in this season's cycle of collapse. A prototype. A blueprint. A glorious breakdown wrapped in glossy skin and crying eyes. But I was still hungry. Tristan's fall gave me a taste of something divine. Something I hadn't fully realized I was starving for. Not just power. Not just control. But chaos, the kind that starts quietly like a moth flapping its wings near a flame, and ends with everything in ashes. So when Adrian walked into my world, the air shifted again. Not in the subtle, begging way that Tristan had slithered in, but like a storm arriving mid-sentence, loud, proud, and crackling with intent. He was the type of man who didn't need to be discovered. He walked like he already owned the room. Hair like jet black ink, skin like rich mahogany polished by sunlight, and a jawline that belonged on a Greek tragedy mask. His smile was dangerous, smug, a little too charming, and entirely practiced. He came in during a casting call I wasn't even supposed to attend. I'd left the selection process to my assistant, Camila, who had impeccable taste and no patience for bullshit. But something pulled me into the viewing room that day, like a sixth sense nudging me toward my next masterpiece. He stood on the white stage platform, wearing nothing but black jeans and a stare that challenged the air around him. Name? Camila asked, clipboard in hand. Adrian Leroux. Of course. A name that sounded like sin dipped in chocolate. And you've modeled where? She continued, cold and clipped. Paris, Milan, Cape Town. But I'm here for something different. Something more dangerous. That's when our eyes met. And just like that, I knew. He wasn't here to be molded. He was here to play. He thought he was the one holding the needle. I watched his audition in silence. Watched the way he held tension in his shoulders. The deliberate stillness in his body, like a man trained to seduce with silence. I could see the darkness underneath, how he fed on being watched, being wanted. The subtle twitch in his jaw when he caught me looking. The smirk that danced on his lips when I didn't blink. Bring him in, I told Camila later, dismissing the rest of the roster without a second glance. You sure? She asked. He seems slippery. That's the point. 2 days later, he walked into my studio. This time alone. His stride was slower, more calculated. He wore a sheer button-down that exposed just enough to dare me, and cologne that lingered behind like a question mark. When he stepped through the archway, I was standing over a dress form, pinning layers of blood-red silk to a corset bodice. The fabric bled onto the floor in a trail behind me. He didn't speak. Neither did I. I turned, letting the silence seduce him first. My gaze landed on him like hands. "You came," I said finally. "I said I would. You always keep your promises?" He stepped closer, eyes roaming the studio then back to me. "Only the ones that'll get me in trouble." I smirked. "Perfect." The next few sessions were electric. Adrian wasn't just a model. He was a fucking performance. Every pose, every gaze, every interaction was choreographed down to the breath. He knew what he was doing, knew how to make people want him without offering them a single inch. But what he didn't know, what none of them ever know, is that I don't need inches. I take everything. I began wrapping him in fabric I hadn't dared use in years. Velvet laced with metallic threads. Sheer mesh stitched with steel. Outfits that bent gender, blurred time, screamed identity crises. And Adrian wore them like they were grown from his skin. The press went wild when I previewed the first look on Instagram. Saint's most daring muse yet. Masculine fluidity redefined. Art meets erotica. But Adrian didn't care about the headlines. He wanted me. Every brush of my hand lingered longer. Every compliment I gave him was poison-dipped sugar. He started showing up early, offering to help late into the night, letting his fingers graze mine when we worked over bodices and stitch lines. It was subtle at first, until it wasn't. One night he brought wine, said it was to celebrate the press traction. We sat on the studio floor, surrounded by spools of thread and scraps of shattered silk. I wore a white tank and leather pants. "No bra," he noticed. "You always this cold to your muses?" he asked, swirling the wine in his glass. "Only the ones worth breaking." His eyes lit with something twisted. "And what if I break you first?" I laughed. A low, dangerous laugh that echoed off the concrete walls. "Sweetheart," I said, crawling toward him like a cat circling prey. "You couldn't even scratch me." I kissed him first, hard, sharp, with teeth. And he kissed me back like he'd been starving for it. We fucked on the fabric table, surrounded by pins and glitter, knocking over a rack of corsets while I moaned his name like a curse. It wasn't romantic. It was warfare. After that night, everything shifted. He stopped being Adrian, the model, and became Adrian, the contender. He challenged my designs, questioned my control. Once, he even suggested I soften the silhouette of a leather trench I'd sculpted to be jagged on purpose. "It's too violent," he said. "That's the point," I snapped. He raised a brow. "Not everything needs to scream to be heard." And that's when I knew we were officially circling the same throne. He wanted to design me. Oh, how deliciously foolish. So I took the game deeper. I brought in another muse, just for one session. A blonde, lean, forgettable thing named Luca. I had him stripped down just like Adrian and started pinning fabric directly onto his skin. Adrian watched from across the room, silent rage pulsing beneath his calm. That night, he cornered me in the dressing room. "You trying to make me jealous?" I leaned against the vanity, lip gloss smudged from the heat of the day. "Why? Are you?" He stepped closer. "You know exactly what you're doing." "Yes," I whispered. "That's why you came back." He grabbed my face, kissed me like he was trying to erase the air between us. I let him. Then I pushed him back with a force that knocked over a stool. "You don't own me," I growled. "I should." That sentence haunted me for weeks. It sat in the corner of every room we were in together, watching us like a ghost we'd invited in with our mouths. And the worst part? A piece of me agreed. Adrian didn't fall the way Tristan did. He didn't cry. Didn't beg. He fought. He fucked me like he was trying to ruin me, said things in bed that scorched my skin. He told me I was the most terrifying thing he'd ever loved. And still, I felt the crack forming. It scared me. So I did what I always do when fear creeps in. I buried it in creation. The next line was brutal. Raw leather, exposed zippers, necklines that choked instead of seduced. Models wore collars. Adrian wore chains. I called the line deconstruct. The critics called it a revelation. A rebirth. The kind of art that only comes from surviving something violent. They weren't wrong. Adrian didn't leave like Tristan. He didn't OD or spiral. He just disappeared. One day, he was in the studio. The next, his number was disconnected, and his Instagram wiped clean. I heard whispers he went underground. Started his own line. Some said he was in Berlin. Others said he'd become a dominatrix's submissive in Prague. I never bothered to find out. He served his purpose. He challenged the designer. But I redesigned him. And I was still hungry. Chapter 3, Mirror Me. Power is a drug. Not just in the way it intoxicates, but in how it changes your chemistry. How it rewires the circuits of your brain to need more, want deeper, push further. I wasn't chasing fame. I had that. I wasn't chasing sex. I had that in every form, flavor, and frequency. What I craved now was something far more elusive. A worthy opponent. And then she walked in. Her name was Celeste, though later, I'd stop using it. It felt too soft, too celestial. She was anything but heavenly. She arrived unannounced, which was rare. Camila usually screened the living hell out of everyone. But that day, fate, or maybe something darker, slipped through the cracks. I was pacing around my showroom, frustrated over a couture piece that wouldn't hang right on the hips, when I heard her voice cut through the air like silk-wrapped venom. "This hemline is criminal. Who let it live?" I turned, and there she was, leaning against the archway, arms crossed, one eyebrow cocked with effortless arrogance. She was tall, almost as tall as me in heels, and built like something sculpted to start wars. Tight angular frame, ash blonde bob, eyes so green they looked like polished emerald stolen from a vault. She wore a vintage Saint Disorder bodysuit, my creation, paired with thigh-high boots and an attitude that dripped from her like Chanel No. 5 mixed with arsenic. "I'm sorry, do I know you?" I asked. "You will," she said, stepping forward. "You're Lyra. I'm what comes next." My first instinct was to cut her down with words sharp enough to draw blood. But something stopped me. Not fear. Not admiration. Curiosity. Camila rushed in a few seconds too late, breathless and flustered. She slipped past the front, said she had a one-on-one booked. "I didn't," Celeste admitted. "But I knew you'd want to see me. The fucking nerve." She didn't ask for permission. She knew. I liked that. "For now." I studied her. "You model." "I become," she said, smiling. "Whatever you need me to be. Victim, villain, vision. Just tell me where to stand." It wasn't what she said. It was how she said it. Like I was the one being recruited. I told Camila to give us the room. She lingered, but I didn't look at her. My attention was tethered to the stranger who walked in like she'd built the floorboards herself. "You wear my line well," I said, nodding toward the bodysuit. "I wear it better than you imagined it." That one stung, but I didn't flinch. I stepped in closer, watching her body for tells. A twitch, a tremble, a mistake. She didn't blink. "Take off your boots," I ordered. "And your jacket. Stand in the light." She obeyed without hesitation, shedding layers like second skin. Her bodysuit clung to her frame like desire incarnate. Under the spotlight, she transformed, posture tightening, expression softening, like she was stepping into a role. I circled her, slow and deliberate. "You think you can handle me?" I asked, barely above a whisper. "No," she replied. "I know I can outlast you." It was a declaration, not a challenge. And I fucking loved it. I let her stay. Over the next week, Celeste slid into my studio like a whisper between walls. She didn't just model. She became the ghost of every unspoken trauma stitched into my designs. She made pain look like poetry. In fittings, she didn't ask for breaks. She didn't complain about pins stabbing skin or corsets bruising ribs. She smiled through it, eyes burning with something both familiar and foreign. She understood the art. But more importantly, she understood me. One night, I watched her alone in the mirrored hallway, trying on one of my unreleased concept gowns. A gown no one else had even been allowed to see. Crimson velvet, neckline slashed to the navel, a cage of satin bones down the back. She twirled, slow and sensual, admiring her own reflection. Her fingers slid down her thighs, up to her collarbone. She kissed her own shoulder, like she was falling in love with herself in my art. It made something deep in my gut twist. Rage? Envy? Lust? I couldn't tell. "Who said you could touch that?" I asked from the doorway, voice laced with venom. She didn't flinch, didn't even turn to look at me. "I didn't touch it," she said. "It touched me." I stormed toward her, grabbed her wrist, spun her to face me. Our chests collided. "What game are you playing?" I hissed. She smirked. "The same one you are." We stared at each other, our breaths tangled like thread caught in a machine. I expected her to back down, to apologize, but she didn't. She stepped in closer. "You're not used to being mirrored, are you?" she whispered, brushing a strand of hair from my face. "You manipulate. You dominate. You control. And you think that makes you untouchable." My heart was pounding. She leaned in, her lips ghosting over mine. "But you bleed like the rest of us, Lyra." She kissed me. Soft. Slow. But with a tension that felt like it could break the earth in half. I didn't kiss her back at first. I let her. I tested the weight of it. The danger. The hunger. And then I kissed her like I wanted to set fire to every thread between us. We fucked in the studio that night. violent, wordless, equal parts punishment and pleasure. Fabric tore, buttons popped, a mannequin shattered on the floor. And when it was over, I lay there panting, staring at the cracked ceiling tiles above us. I felt exposed in a way I never had before. She hadn't just entered my body. She had read it. Days blurred after that. We created like maniacs. I pushed her into contortions no other model could hold. Draped her in my darkest, most personal pieces. Things I hadn't even named yet. She told me I was a genius. That she saw me more clearly than anyone ever had. She whispered it between bites. Between moans. Between breaths that smelled like wine and recklessness. But then it started. The mimicking. She began dressing like me. Speaking in clipped syllables the way I did. Carrying a sketchbook. Drawing concepts. Suggesting adjustments. One morning, I found her coaching another model in my tone. Posing her like I would. Eyes hard. Voice soft. Manipulative. Who the fuck do you think you are? I asked. She tilted her head. Learning from the best. No. You're copying me. Isn't that what muses do? She asked. Reflect the artist? I slammed her sketchbook onto the floor, pages scattering like dead birds. I made you, I growled. No, she said, eyes dark and steady. You woke me. And that's when I knew I'd gone too far. I hadn't just created a muse. I'd created a monster. She started texting my clients behind my back. Booking private shoots. Posing in unreleased garments. Even leaked a teaser to a fashion blog that quoted her as Saint Disorder's rising co-designer. I should have destroyed her right then. But I couldn't. Because every time I tried to sever the thread, I found myself tangled deeper. Her voice haunted me. Her body called to me. Her ambition excited me. She was everything I was, reflected and reversed. And somewhere in that fucked up mirror I lost control. The final blow came when she entered a competition under her name, wearing my designs. Not a reinterpretation. My actual unreleased designs. The judges hailed her as a bold, emerging force. Said her work was hauntingly familiar, yet distinctly new. I watched her on stage, flashing her serpent smile, holding the trophy in one hand and my legacy in the other. And I smiled, too, because while she thought she was winning, she had no idea what I was about to design next. Chapter 4, Seam Ripper. There's a moment when the seam starts to split. Not the big dramatic tear, no, that comes later. I'm talking about the first moment. That tiny stretch of thread. The whisper of fabric pulling apart. You don't always hear it. But I do. I've made a career out of hearing what others miss. And when I felt Celeste start to slip from my fingers, when I realized she was no longer orbiting me but carving her own universe, I heard the first thread snap. And it was deafening. She thought she could outmaneuver me. That she could steal my patterns, replicate my voice, wear my silhouette like a second skin, and claim it as her own. She thought she could walk into my temple, light her own fire, and make me bow. Cute. But the thing about playing with fire? You forget who invented the match. The day after she won that competition, the one where she wore my designs and batted her lashes like the Phoenix Queen of Fashion, I sat alone in my penthouse. No lights. No music. Just me, a glass of absinthe, and the dress she stole, folded neatly across my lap. The silk still smelled like her. A mix of perfume, sweat, and betrayal. I didn't cry. I didn't scream. I planned. Because a bitch like me doesn't spiral. She strategizes. First, I locked down the studio. I had Camila change every passcode, every door key, every piece of digital access we had. If Celeste tried to walk in again, she'd be met with cold steel and a flashing red denial light. Then I called my lawyer. I want to know exactly how many designs are legally registered under my name, and I want an NDA drafted that would make Satan himself hesitate. He didn't ask questions. He never does. We've been here before. Once that was in place, I turned to my real work, reclaiming the narrative. Celeste wasn't just a threat. She was a mirror. And mirrors can be shattered. I started small. Whispers. At a Vogue gala, I stood beside a journalist I knew had a taste for scandal and softly said, "You know, Celeste used to work for me. She was my muse, until I caught her copying my sketches. I didn't look her way once. Just sipped my champagne and moved on. That's all it took." The next morning, page 6 ran with it. Saint Disorder's shadow. Is Celeste just a beautiful thief? She posted a denial on Instagram, an elegant black and white portrait of herself with the caption, "I don't steal. I inspire." It got over 80,000 likes. Too easy. The next phase was surgical. I had a man named Rafi, an old fling, ex-military, now a cybersecurity ghost, dig into her laptop. I knew she'd be reckless, riding the high of her little win. I guessed right. He found dozens of screenshots from my unreleased folders. Confidential sketches. Fabric orders. Color stories. I had proof, but I didn't leak it. Not yet. Power isn't about having the knife. It's about letting them know you could cut them anytime you want. And she knew. I saw it in the way her eyes shifted when we crossed paths at a rooftop show in Brooklyn. Her smile faltered for a split second when I brushed past her, slow and calm, and whispered into her hair, "You look beautiful tonight, thief." She turned, lips parted, probably ready to claw back. But I was already gone. By the end of the week, I sent her a gift, a vintage dress from my first collection, wrapped in tissue tied with black ribbon. Inside was a note written in my own blood-red ink, a reminder of where you came from. "Love always, mother." She didn't respond, but she wore it 3 nights later to an after-party. Of course she did. See, what Celeste didn't understand, what she still doesn't, is that the closer you dance to my flame, the more of yourself you burn away. I don't destroy people all at once. I dismantle them, button by button, stitch by stitch, until they don't even remember what they looked like before me. And then I take what's left and turn it into art. I began creating again, more feral than ever. My new line was called Needle and Bone. Each piece was a dissection, leather carved like flesh, chiffon dyed to resemble bruises, corsets that constricted like guilt. The models cried during fittings, and I fed off it. I sketched like a woman possessed. I sewed like a surgeon, and in every piece, I buried her. One look was a gown made entirely of twisted black ribbons, interwoven so tightly it looked like it had been built to trap someone inside. I called it the mimic. Another was a trench coat with slashed lapels and zippers that served no purpose, just chaos stitched into structure. That one, doppelganger. The centerpiece? A dress made from broken mirrors, hand-cut, stitched into mesh sharp enough to bleed. It was dangerous to wear, beautiful to behold. I named it Celeste. The night I unveiled the line, the entire industry held its breath. The room smelled like smoked vanilla and tension. People whispered as the models walked, gasped as the lights caught the reflective shards. I could feel the audience trying to make sense of the violence, the sadness, the madness of it all. I just smiled. She was in the third row, wearing white. Of course. I caught her eye during the final walk. And I winked. After the show, she followed me into the dressing room. Her heels clicked like a warning bell behind me. I didn't turn. "You're insane," she hissed. "Tell me something I don't know." She stepped closer, eyes blazing. "You're obsessed with me." I finally looked at her. "No," I said, calm as ash. "I created you. And now I'm editing my mistake." She slapped me. Hard. My head turned from the force, my cheek blazing red. But I laughed. Not out of amusement. Out of something darker. Something victorious. "You felt that?" I asked. "Good. That means I still own you." She stood there, shaking, breathing like a trapped animal. She hated me. She wanted me. She feared me. Perfect. That night, I didn't sleep. I walked my studio barefoot, fingers trailing across fabric bolts and mannequin spines. I lit candles, played violins through the speaker system. I poured wine, sat cross-legged on the floor, and replayed every moment we'd ever shared. And somewhere between the first and second bottle, I whispered to no one, "I'm not done with her." Because I wasn't. Destruction was only the first layer. Next, I'd make her beg to stay. Chapter 5, Silk Noose. It wasn't enough to destroy her. Not yet. Destruction is easy. I've done that. Burned muses to the ground, watched them scatter like ash in the wind. But unraveling someone? Slowly, intimately, making them beg for the very noose that will strangle them. That's an art. And Celeste, she was the perfect canvas. After Needle and Bone premiered, she vanished. No social posts. No sightings. Not even a whisper in the scene. For 2 full weeks, it was like she'd been erased. But I knew better. She was hiding. Wounded animals always do. And like any predator worth her salt, I let her think I'd moved on. I posted smiling photos with models. Champagne in hand. Poolside meetings. Late-night fittings. Nothing too polished. Just enough curated chaos to paint the illusion of thriving. Then I wrote her a letter. Not an email. Not a text. An honest-to-God, handwritten, ink-on-paper letter. No logo. No return address. Just 4 words in my signature crimson ink. "Let's finish this, love." I knew she'd come. And she did. 3 nights later, at 3:17 a.m., I heard the buzzer buzz once, short, hesitant, like a secret. I buzzed her in without a word. She walked into my penthouse drenched in moonlight and silence. No makeup, black hoodie, eyes rimmed red like she hadn't slept in days. She looked smaller somehow, diminished, not weak, but weathered. As if carrying the weight of me had eroded the edge she once flaunted like armor. We didn't speak. I poured her a drink. She took it without a thank you. And we sat, just the two of us, in the dark, wine between us, music low, tension higher than God. You humiliated me, she said finally. No, I said, staring into my glass. I revealed you. Why did you call me back? Because I'm not done with you. She laughed once. Dry. Bitter. So this is what now? Another manipulation? Another chapter in your twisted little fashion opera? I looked her dead in the eye. No. This is the part where you come home. She blinked. That was all I needed. You see, the cruelest thing you can do to someone isn't to hurt them. It's to convince them they belong to you. Even after the pain. Especially after the pain. She moved in 3 days later. At first, it was under the guise of collaboration. We told the world we were creating a dual collection. Saint and Sin. She'd be the Sin, of course. I didn't care what the press thought. This wasn't about fashion. It was about power. Our days bled together in a haze of silk and sabotage. We designed side by side, threading chaos into fabric. We drank too much. Slept too little. We fought over colors, textures, necklines. We screamed. We kissed. We clawed. Some nights we shared a bed. Other nights she slept on the studio floor, wrapped in scraps of lace and rage. I'd wake to find her sketching in the dark, hair wild, eyes glowing with hunger. She was haunted, and I was the ghost. We made love like war, rough, primal, punishing. One night, I tied her wrists with measuring tape, pulled her close, and whispered into her mouth, "Tell me who you belong to." She didn't answer, so I made her come until she cried. She curled into my chest afterward, shaking, whispering my name like a prayer and a curse. The next morning, she was gone. Again, that became our pattern. She would disappear, sometimes for hours, sometimes days. And every time, she came back thinner, sharper, like she'd shed some part of herself out there just to be light enough to crawl back to me. She was unraveling, but what I hadn't accounted for. So was I, because there were moments, brief, cruel moments, when I wasn't sure who was pulling the strings anymore. She'd started filming me when I wasn't looking. Little clips. Me sketching. Me sleeping. Me screaming at a mannequin for slouching. Once, she caught me crying in the bathtub, drunk off absinthe, smearing lipstick onto a napkin like it held secrets. She showed me the videos. Not as a threat. As a mirror. "Look at you," she whispered. "You're beautiful when you break." I should have slapped her. I kissed her instead. And when we fought, oh God, when we fought, it was biblical. She threw a pair of shears at me once. Missed my face by an inch. I broke her sketchpad over my knee. She poured red dye on one of my gowns. I locked her out on the balcony naked in the rain. And then we'd fuck like the world was ending. Love. No, this wasn't love. It was codependency with a designer label. A shared addiction. And the high was starting to rot us. Camila staged an intervention. Sort of. She pulled me aside in the middle of a shoot and said, "Lyra, you're not designing anymore. You're bleeding." I laughed in her face. But later, I stood in front of my own closet and realized she was right. I hadn't sketched anything new in weeks. I'd been recycling fragments. Fractals of past collections. Sewing pain into pain. Celeste was no longer my muse. She was my mirror. And I didn't like what I saw. So I made a choice. I invited her to dinner, some exclusive rooftop affair with industry people, overpriced wine, and music so soft it felt like an apology. I had her wear the original Saint Disorder piece she first walked into my studio wearing. I wore black. Hair slicked back. Red lips. No earrings. Bare throat. "I want a toast," I said as the sun set behind her. "To what?" she asked, suspicious. "To endings." She blinked. "Are you breaking up with me?" she said, like we were 12. "No," I said. "I'm reclaiming myself." I stood, leaned close, and whispered against her cheek. "I don't need a mirror anymore. I remember who I am." She didn't speak. She didn't cry. She simply stood, kissed my cheek, and left. And this time, she didn't come back. Not that night. Not the next. Not the week after. Her things were still in my closet. Her perfume still on my pillows. Her unfinished sketches still on the wall. But Celeste, gone. For good. And for the first time in months, I felt something strange. Not triumph. Not heartbreak. Silence. The kind of silence that settles in when the noise finally stops, and all you can hear is yourself breathing. I looked around my studio, my penthouse, my life, and I asked the question that had been waiting in the walls. Who am I without the chaos? Chapter 6, The Silence Between Stitches. It didn't hit me right away. Her absence. It crept in, soft and slow, like dusk bleeding into the corners of the sky. The kind of absence that doesn't announce itself with slammed doors or screaming exits. It just settles. Like dust. Like rot. Like the hollow sound of your own breath echoing through too many rooms. At first, I told myself it was good. Healthy. Necessary. Celeste was poison wrapped in velvet. Seductive, brilliant, unpredictable. And I'd swallowed every drop. My bloodstream still pulsed with her voice, her laugh, her scent. But she was gone. And I had to detox. Had to come back to myself. Reclaim my studio. My body. My mind. But self-reclamation is not as cinematic as people like to believe. It's not all yoga and wine and triumphant music swelling in the background. Sometimes it's standing naked in front of your mirror at 2 a.m., staring at your own reflection and whispering, "Who the fuck are you now?" It's reaching for your sketchbook and realizing your hands won't move. It's lying in bed and hearing the click of the front door in your head, even though you know she's not coming back. The first week without her was quiet. Too quiet. No slamming drawers. No late-night laughter. No fights. No music. No Celeste humming while she tore up fabric and claimed she was revolutionizing texture. No perfume lingering in the halls. No misplaced coffee mugs. No sketches taped to the mirror. Just silence. Camila came by twice, checking on me. She brought lemon pastries from our favorite bakery and asked if I'd started sketching again. I told her yes. I lied. I couldn't touch a pencil. Not because I had nothing to draw, but because everything I saw was her. Celeste in motion. Celeste in stillness. Celeste folded over a dress form like a broken wing. Celeste smoking in the bathtub, hair wet, eyes glassy. Celeste screaming. Laughing. Coming. Celeste leaving. Every gown I imagined started to look like her. Every cut mirrored the curve of her hip. Every shade of red became her lip. Every black the pit of her pupils when she was furious. And when I tried to design something else, anything else, it all felt dead. Flat. Soulless. Because without chaos, without her, I wasn't creating. I was miming my old life. And I hated it. So I did something I hadn't done in years. I left the city. I packed a single duffel bag, told Camila to cancel everything for 2 weeks, and drove upstate to the cabin I used to visit before the world knew my name. Before I became Lyra Saint. Before I started feeding off the destruction of people who loved me too much to leave until they broke. The cabin was quiet. Cold. Dusty. Perfect. I stayed up the first night drinking whiskey on the porch, wrapped in a wool blanket, watching the stars in silence. My phone was off. My laptop was buried in my bag. For once, I wanted to hear what existed under the noise. Under the brand. Under the bitch. Under the artist. Under the monster. I was raw. Exposed. And for the first time in a long time, lonely. Not the glamorous, dramatic loneliness of a tortured genius. The real kind. The kind that makes your stomach ache. The kind that steals your appetite. The kind that makes you cry at commercials and songs you've heard 1,000 times without feeling a thing. I journaled. Mostly bullshit. Stream of consciousness. Scribbles. Some poems. A few dark lines about control and abandonment and hunger. But something cracked open in me that week. Something I hadn't expected. Grief. Not for Celeste exactly. But for the version of me I had lost chasing her. You see, people talk about toxic relationships like they're easy to leave. Like once you rip the band-aid off, you heal. But what they don't tell you is how comfortable toxicity becomes when it mirrors your own. Celeste wasn't the only manipulator in our story. She was just the one who reflected it back with a prettier face. By day 6 in the cabin, I started sketching again. Slowly. Rough lines. Abstract concepts. Things I didn't fully understand. Dresses that looked like cage doors. Suits that unraveled into ribbons. Boots with no soles. Capes shaped like scars. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't polished. But it was honest. One afternoon, I found a feather outside on the porch, jet black, frayed at the edges. I stared at it for 20 minutes. Then I pinned it to the center of a page and wrote. She never flew. She just fell in style. I laughed so hard I cried. By day 10, I was sleeping through the night. By day 12, I had 3 full concept boards and a folder titled Closure Collection. And by day 14, I came home, The city felt different. Not louder. Not colder. Just less threatening. I walked back into my studio with a different breath in my chest. Not the manic, desperate inhale of a woman trying to outcreate her demons, but the slow, measured breath of someone who had survived herself. I poured a glass of water, lit a single candle, and opened my laptop. Hundreds of emails, most of them noise, but one caught my eye. No subject line, no body text, just an attachment. I clicked. It was a video. Celeste, sitting in front of the camera, wearing nothing but an oversized shirt I recognized as mine. No makeup, hair wild, eyes red. She didn't speak for the first 10 seconds. Then she leaned in and whispered. I lied when I said I was done. The screen went black. And just like that, my breath caught, the thread pulled tight, and I realized the story wasn't over. Not yet. Chapter 7, Final Fitting. There's a silence that comes before impact. Not the kind that's peaceful. The kind that's thick. Pregnant. Alive. It presses against your skin like static before lightning strikes. That was the silence in the room when I watched her video again. Celeste, wrapped in my shirt, eyes heavy with something far more dangerous than love. Regret. Or maybe intention. I lied when I said I was done. Those words looped in my head for hours. I tried to ignore them. To file them away under manipulation tactics. An old trick in the toxic playbook. But this wasn't a game anymore. Not for her. Not for me. Something had shifted. We'd broken each other, stitched ourselves back together wrong, and now the seams were unraveling. I poured a drink. Then I watched it again. This time, I paused the video frame by frame, studied her face, her posture, the way her hands trembled in her lap. She was scared, but not of me, of herself. And I understood, because I had been scared too. It's one thing to play the villain. It's another to realize you've become it. Not by design, not by intent, but by necessity. To survive, to protect, to stay one step ahead in a world that eats women like us alive. She didn't say where she was, didn't ask to meet, didn't beg. She just sent the video and vanished again. But I couldn't let it sit there. Couldn't pretend it hadn't cracked something open in me that I'd buried beneath ambition and sex and thread counts. So I did the only thing I knew how to do. I built something. A new line. The last line. I called it closure. No frills. No PR stunts. No models. Just me. In my studio. Alone. Designing every piece by hand. Bleeding onto fabric. Ripping old gowns apart and turning them into something new. A collection of ghosts stitched into redemption. Each piece was an exhale. The first was a gown made from shredded past collections. Each one representing a muse I'd burned. Tristan. Adrian. Even the faceless ones. I sewed the remnants together into a patchwork of broken promises. Called it the graveyard dress. The second piece was a long black coat with raw edges and a hidden red silk lining. Anger on the outside, blood on the inside. It was heavy, like grief. I wore it for 3 days straight while I worked. Then came the final piece, the wedding dress. Not for a bride, for a funeral. It was high-collared, bone white, sleeves that dragged. The hemline was stained with ink, charcoal, and ashes from burned sketches. There were no jewels. Just hand-sewn seams, exposed threads, and across the back, a single phrase embroidered in black. You made me real. It was a love letter. And an ending. I scheduled a private showing. No audience. No cameras. Just a single runway, lit by 100 white candles in a warehouse I'd used once when I first launched Saint Disorder. I didn't send invitations. I sent one address. To one person. Celeste. I didn't know if she'd come. I didn't prepare a plan if she did. I just stood backstage, listening to the music build, slow cello, echoing footsteps, soft rain effects. My hands trembled for the first time in years. Not from fear, but anticipation. And then, she walked in. Not down the runway. Not through the front. She came backstage. Through the back door. Like she always had. There she was. Hair shorter. Dyed darker. Eyes swollen from tears she'd clearly fought. She wore black leather pants, a sheer blouse, no bra. She didn't smile. Didn't speak. She just stared at me. Like I was something she didn't expect to still exist. Alive. Whole. Hers. You came, I whispered. I almost didn't, she said. But I needed to see you one last time. I stepped toward her. Do you hate me? Yes, she breathed. And I miss you. We stood inches apart. Both of us breathing like survivors pulled from the wreckage of the same crash. I made something, I said. For you. For us. She looked past me toward the runway, and then nodded. We walked together. No one else in the room. No applause. Just flickering candlelight and the scent of rose oil and wax. I stepped onto the runway and walked alone, wearing the funeral dress. Her footsteps echoed behind me. Not on stage. In shadow. She watched. Silent. Reverent. I stopped at the end. Turned. Let her see me. See everything. I reached into my pocket. Pulled out a single key. I held it up. She stepped forward and took it. It wasn't metaphorical. It was real. The key to the storage room in my studio. Where all the original sketches lived. All the secrets. All the pain. All the beauty. All of us. I'm letting go, I said. I'm not asking you to come back. I'm not asking you to stay. But I'm done punishing you for seeing me. She blinked. Tears fell. She didn't wipe them. She just nodded. Then she kissed my cheek. And left. No grand goodbye. No promises. Just silence. But this time, it didn't feel empty. It felt clean. The next morning, I shut down Saint Disorder. No press release. No drama. Just a locked door and a new beginning. I moved into a smaller studio. No muses. No mirrors. Just me and fabric. Designing not from pain, but from peace. And when I think of Celeste now, I don't ache. I smile. Because she didn't ruin me. She revealed me. And maybe that's what a muse really is. Not someone you use. But someone who makes you look so deep inside yourself that you finally see what's been hiding there all along. I still wear the funeral dress sometimes. But not for mourning. For memory. For survival. For rebirth. This is the last line I'll ever sew. And every stitch? It's mine.